Welcome back to Doth Protest Too Much, a Protestant historical theology podcast. If you've not already, please, however you listen to us, whether it's through Apple or another streaming service, and you're able to give our show a rating, please do so. Please go and give us how many stars you honestly feel we deserve. And we want to get somewhat of a percentage of the viewership that Joe Rogan Experience has. I think that's the name of Joe Rogan's show. So. We are back, and we are back here with Zach Neubauer, who's the president of EFAC, Evangelical Fellowship in the Anglican Communion, the USA group of EFAC. We've had an episode recently about their last conference where our friend Jacob Balma-Sims came on and talked about that. I went to the conference last year for EFAC because I'm a member, and I did an episode on here about it. And Zach's also been on the show as well. About, I don't know, how long ago was that, Zach? Like,
just over a year ago. Because yeah. I was still in Georgia and now out in California. We've been out in California for just over a year. So,
yeah. And I want to hear a little bit about what your ministry's looking like out there. I know we haven't connected in a while on that, but yeah, so Zach is the president of EFAC, and it was one of our first episodes for Doth Protest. I think it was our fifth or sixth episode. And in that episode, we kind of like define broadly what it means to be an evangelical in Anglicanism. So not that it's like its own denomination, but I guess it's a culture or a group, a subgroup within Anglicanism that are comfortable with the word evangelical. I know a lot of our culture is not comfortable with that word right now. And we explained, you know, what that was, and we touched back on it in other episodes as well. And so with that ground kind of laid already, we're going to get a little bit into Zach's interests, some of his influences, some of the some authors, both the present and past, who Zach feels and you know, we all feel are important to look to for, you know, guidance and to be theologically informed as Anglicans. And so Zach, hi, welcome back. And James is here with us too, man. I didn't mention that James is with us, and so we got three of us on the show. Should make for good conversation. Zach, how's your how is California and your life and ministry since we last talked?
Yeah, California's pretty good. I'm out in the Episcopal Diocese of Northern California, which is geographically a huge diocese. Basically everything north of San Francisco, all the way to Oregon border, all the way to Nevada, all the way to the Pacific coast. So at the very southern end of it right now, family attends the parish in Sonoma, but I've just become the part-time priest in charge at a parish closer to Sacramento, which is about an hour or so. So it requires a little bit of creativity, but it's something that I was willing to undertake, and the diocese was willing to let me do, and the parish was happy to work with it. So just started that. First official Sunday was 2 weeks ago. So. Yeah, new life and enjoying our time out here. So, and it's good to see you again, Drew, and to be with you guys and to see James through the computer screen. A lot of interaction on Facebook and whatnot, but good to finally actually see each other and be chatting with each other. So,
absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, and James, I know I imagine you intend to at some point experience an EFAC gathering. And so it's a really great, I had a good experience. I mean, I regretfully couldn't come to the last conference, but the first one, I just felt very uplifted. I felt like, what's the word to say? Not that it felt good to be around clergy and lay people alike, both from the Episcopal Church and ACNA. There's not many settings where you'll have people from both of those groups having, you know, genuine fellowship and worshiping together and discussing the church together. So that part alone was uplifting, but also just that the gospel of grace, the gospel of Jesus Christ, which saves us from our own selves, who are our worst enemies, that's to hear, yep, to know that that is such a central emphasis for that group in a wider church culture where gospel can unfortunately mean something very different and even antithetical to that. For some others, it was such a ray of hope for me to see that. And so, Zach, you were coming on to talk about, yeah, some of your interests, like we just mentioned. And we're going to start with a historical figure, Charles Simeon. James and I, before our episode, we both kind of talked about what would be on this episode. And we're both ignorant when it comes to a lot of more recent evangelical Anglicanism. Funny enough, is even though we both consider ourselves in ways evangelicals, we're very stuck in the Reformation a lot, James, yeah, and I. We just don't want to move past the 16th century. We live in the past. So, but I know you mentioned Charles Simeon is kind of, in a way, an important bridge from the Reformation to really the modern evangelicalism in the Anglican Church. So tell us a little bit about him. What are some of the I mean, we could do some biographical stuff, but I guess you could give a brief overview, but also just what are some insights that he brings and why he resonates with you and why you think he's so important? I mean, just go ahead and take it away on that.
Yeah, no, I think, thanks. That's a great intro. And definitely. I feel that the Reformation is sorely underlooked within kind of global Anglicanism, and we need to start there as, I mean, so many would argue, well, the church was in England before the Reformation. And yes, that is true. But the Church of England doesn't start until the Reformation. I would strongly contend that. And and consider myself very much a Cranmerian, another one of my, Thomas Cranmer, another one of my heroes. But also seeing how we get to where we're at today, both positively and negatively. I think we're well aware that that our whatever jurisdiction we're in, got a lot of warts, a lot of issues, just like any other denomination. But I think it's important to own a lot of that. So you have Charles Simeon, and he's born in 1759, so kind of the middle of the 18th century. I mean, if you think about the Book of Common Prayer in 1662 edition, maybe being the closing, the bookend on the Reformation period of the Church of England. So he's coming along about 100 years after that, and you see the Church of England kind of settling in a little bit more, and the Elizabethan settlement. I mean, that's the phrase. I mean, so we're kind of trying to get along and trying to get used to each other and moving forward. Mm-hmm. And Simeon comes along, and he's born to a wealthy family. He goes to Eton. I mean, one of the most prestigious, they wouldn't let me into Eton talking like that, prestigious schools in England, and then goes off to King's College, Cambridge, and where he studies. And it's in his first year at King's College. You're still in that point of time where, in order to attend Oxford and Cambridge, you have to be in the Church of England. You have to be a faithful communicant. You have to be signing off on the 39 Articles. And so Charles Simeon is going and realizes that he's going to have to take communion on Easter Sunday. So he grows up in a family that's not very religious. And so for the first time, he's kind of asking some spiritual questions about what it means to take communion. And he says in his autobiography or biography, he says he feels that the devil himself is more able to take communion than he is. That's how uncomfortable he is with it. And so he spends a few weeks reading and studying and trying to convince himself that he should go forward for communion. And has what we might call a conversion experience. I mean, has that realization that Christ has been given for him. It's not his worthiness is not why he comes to the table, but because of Christ's worthiness. And so he does that, and that's in 1779. And so 1782, he becomes a deacon. He's ordained. And as part of that, what I'll call a conversion experience, I recognize that might not be the best term, or maybe different people would understand that term different ways. But what comes of that conversion experience is a change of heart and is a lively faith. There you go. There's a Reformation term for you. And so he's embracing scripture. He's embracing the prayer book. And so he's going forward for ordination, but he doesn't see anybody else around like him. You have enthusiasts during that time, those members of churches that usually fall outside the Church of England. And so he's in some ways resembles these enthusiasts who are preaching for conversion and whatnot, but he's committed to staying within the Church of England. And he actually goes, and I can't find the text of it. I was trying to find it as before we got started, but he actually takes out an ad in the newspaper wherein he describes his conversion experience. And he says, this is who I am. This is my theology. If there is any clergyman in the entire Church of England who agrees with me, I will come and be your curate for free. That's his, he can't find anybody else like him. He eventually has a curacy, and he is placed at Holy Trinity Church in Cambridge, and it's a weird situation because he's there technically as a curate, and so maybe for those who aren't familiar with that term. He's ordained as a deacon, but still waiting to be ordained as a priest. And usually you'd be working underneath another priest to kind of help you with that transition. He's given the run of the place to himself, and which sets up some conflict with his parishioners, because he's not technically the vicar of the church. He doesn't have keys, and so the senior warden locks him out of the church building. That's how opposed to this message that they are to him. He's not easily defeated, and so first they lock the pew doors, so they still enclose pews that families would either buy or rent, and that they have locks on the outside. So first the congregation takes to not coming to church and then locking the pew doors so that no one else can come to church to hear him preach. And so he goes and gets some benches and sets them up in the aisle of the nave so that people can still come to church without sitting in the pews. And that's when the senior warden then says, okay, we're just going to lock the door so you can't get into the building. And it's incredibly, he continues on. I think I would have given up at that point. But he continues on and has an experience almost 10 years later, or still at the parish, where he passes someone in the street and they say hello to him, one of his parishioners. And he writes in his journal that night just how overjoyed he is that one of his parishioners saw him and acknowledged him on the street. So not an auspicious start, but he ends up staying at Holy Trinity Cambridge for 55 years and preaching the gospel, seeing lives changed. And out of that, some of what happens, he helps found the Church Missionary Society, one of the very first missionary societies, sends one of his, one of the folks that had, one of the gentlemen who worked under him to India to be a missionary in India. He sets up what he calls conversation parties, where he invites especially young college men into his home, and they discuss what it means to be a priest and to what it means to preach the gospel. Mm-hmm. He's also one of the big voices behind the push for Bible societies. So printing and distributing copies of scripture freely to people both in England and abroad. And one of the just very smart things he does, and I'm not sure if many listeners will be familiar with this, but there's a practice within the Church of England called patronage. And what happens is that in a given parish, the each parish in the Church of England, each geographical area that has a church associated with it, has a patron. And this, it's a, I won't go into all the details, but essentially the patron is usually a wealthy member of the community, and they are allowed to put names forward to the bishop to fill a vacancy as the church, the vicar, what we might call a rector. And back in Simeon's time, there was money to be made. As a patron, you could sell your patronage to another person. So what Simeon does is, in a time when these patronages are not seen to have a lot of value because no one really cares who the vicar is, he buys up almost 42 of these patronages, which gives him the right to put a name forward for the vicar in these 42 different parishes. And so the combination of all these things, of being in a college town like Cambridge, training and raising up young men who become clergy, and then having the right or the ability to put forward these young men for positions in the Church of England, give him a ultimately an immense I can't think of the word for it, allows him to do a lot in the Church of England by the time that he influenced, that's the word I'm thinking of. So it gives him tons of influence by the time he, time of his death. And so, this influence isn't just limited to his lifetime, but continues to be felt outside of, long past his death. And so even today, Church Society, an organization in the Church of England that some of your listeners may be familiar with, they still hold, he leaves these patronages in trust to an organization that eventually becomes Church Society. And now Church Society has purchased more, and I think are up to 100 and almost 150 parishes where they have the patronage at.
Wow.
And so the rules have changed. It's not as not as helpful as it was in Simeon's time, but as the evangelist J. John, Church of England evangelist, puts it, he said, Charles Simeon made posterity a priority. He was really thinking not just about what could be accomplished in his lifetime, and not just about what could be accomplished by him, but what might be accomplished by others well after his lifetime.
Right. Yeah, there's a narrative I hear when, you mentioned how you kind of rehearse some of the history, or give an overview of the history leading up to the time of Simeon. And there's a narrative I hear a lot that, you know, the Church of England was kind of in a too much of a settled place, maybe a complacent place, you know, during that period of, like, I guess the 18th century. I think it's important to, I mean, very few times in Anglican history has Anglicanism ever been at peace. You know, it's forged in the English Reformation. And then for the period of 100 years, there's these different warring parties within the Church of England. And then you have, of course, the issue Richard Hooker dealt with separatists and Puritans that wanted to reform the Church of England farther, or not reform it necessarily, but take it in directions, reforming, yeah, but take it in directions that others did not want to see. So you have, like, a lot of, like, I'm sure settlement was in a way welcome. I know you get, like, and you mentioned the Elizabethan settlement, which is, of course, the official name we give, or that was given to, you know, the Church of England finally, you know, coming up with formularies and customs and defining what it was. But I can, you know, the general narrative I hear, and I'm sure it's basically true, is that, yeah, by the time that the 18th century is in full motion, that the church is not in full motion. It's just kind of it's high and dry. It's emotionless. You know, I don't know if you've heard this kind of narrative of Anglican history, of 18th century Anglicanism. And Wesley is usually seen as, like, a energetic force that wakes up.
Yeah.
Anglicanism and with his Methodist movement. But is Simeon kind of seen that way too? Is kind of a burst of energy onto the scene?
Yeah, so I mean, he's not alone. I mean, that's a good connection with the Wesleys. I mean, the Wesleys come before him, mm-hmm. but it's still, I mean, it's part of the Great Awakening movement. I mean, in what we would call a Great Awakening in the U.S., a similar thing is happening in Great Britain and Wales, especially. But over there, it's generally referred to as the evangelical revival. Okay. I gave a very, very brief understanding of kind of that gap between between Cranmer and the original reformers and Simeon. But whatever you think exactly of that period, I think that kind of way of thinking, the burst of energy is what is going on with the Wesleys and then continues on with Simeon. One of the reasons I'm drawn to Simeon is because he remained within the Church of England. And so for so many who, the example on this side of the pond, I mean, so many folks who were awakened in the Great Awakening, felt that then it was their duty to leave the churches that they had once been part of. So you see a huge rise in Baptist and Methodist churches in the Great Awakening on this side of the pond, and a precipitous decline among Episcopal churches and a lot of Presbyterian churches, Congregationalist churches, because it was seen as, well, that my old church is dead, and now I'm coming into this, yeah, this kind of new and living church, and that's obviously better.
And that's always been my issue with kind of later Protestantism, with, I guess, like the strands of Protestantism that came out of the Great Awakening and the revivalist scene. I think on one end, the positive is that it probably ignited a fervor for the gospel was not societally not there, and a lot of people were reached. But also on the flip side of that, I think it put such an emphasis on, well, like you said, that more established churches up to the time were now deemed like dead churches. They weren't living, right? They were, it wasn't spontaneous prayer. extemporaneous prayer. That now those were the hallmarks, the defining of what being a true Christian was. And that's always kind of the issue I've, as much as I call myself Protestant, I know when a lot of people hear that word Protestant, that's the image that comes to mind. And so I guess that's, so when I see people like Simeon and these people that stayed within the structures, within the established churches, I'm always curious, like, okay, obviously this is a new flavor of, it's a new flavor of evangelicalism than what you get in like the 16th century with Cranmer and the Reformation. Obviously they're not jumping on to the fever you see everywhere else with the, you know, they're staying within established churches and trying to spread the gospel within there. So I'm wondering how did they deal with kind of the tension between, like, how did like 19th century evangelicals within the Episcopal Church and Church of England, where did they kind of hold the line or kind of, I guess, where did they see themselves as different from other, I guess, Great Awakening Protestantism? I mean, from everything else that was going on, what would be the, I mean, what was kind of their reasoning for staying, I guess?
I mean, I think it's... And this could be a whole nother conversation that I would
I don't know. My brain, I'm just going where my mind is going.
I think though there is, and I think it's a reality that we continue to see today, especially within Anglicanism. In the Church of England, you called it a different flavor than the Reformers. I mean, Simeon sees himself as a continuation of the Reformation. Right. So it's not, because of folks like Cranmer and Latimer and whatnot, he sees himself as recovering a lot of that. Okay. And so it's not something that doesn't have a place and needs a new place. Mm-hmm. He says, well, this is just a living out of the prayer book and our formularies, is his general contention. Whereas, on this side of the pond, on the American side, you don't see that, or it's not recognized as much. I think that there's an advantage there, on the Church of England side, in that this isn't foreign to Anglicanism, and I can hear the angry emailing pinning coming through already. But Simeon thinks this is true Anglicanism. I mean, this is just getting back to what we were doing 100 so odd years ago, but we got waylaid by Laud and by folks like that who promoted more of an Arminian or kind of perspective on things.
Right. Moral theology and
well, and that's one of the things that seems interesting to me about Simeon, is that he's not the father of a revivalist movement like the Wesley brothers. He's not even on the Calvinist side of things, a revivalist like the Puritans.
Yeah.
He seems to me to hew pretty closely to a reformational model while having some of the hallmarks of the evangelical revival / Great Awakening, which I think makes him, if not unique, then certainly rare. Because at this time too, you have, with the First Great Awakening, a very emotionalistic Christianity that's developed with, the heart strangely warmed of John Wesley, right? And others that we see today echoed in American evangelicalism, the sort of, I've got to make a decision for Jesus. And this decision for Jesus that I'm making is so emotional that I have to go and cry at a makeshift altar, or else I'm not really a Christian.
Yeah.
James and I were going to do an episode where we just talked crap on decision theology. It'll happen.
Pietism. Yeah.
where we talk through the unhelpful and unhealthy implications of decision theology.
Yeah, it's more so like you said. I'm making my decision in such a way that I have to go cry at the altar. It has to be like a public affirmation. Conversion. It's more than just the Holy Spirit's work on my heart. That it's actually something that has to be verified and testified before everyone. As if baptism wasn't that. Sorry, but
I think, to your point of why doesn't, or what prevents Simeon from kind of, I mean, sliding is already a pejorative. So I don't mean that. But I mean becoming, by being more like the Wesleys or being something like that. I think it's probably I mean, so some of Simeon's weaknesses, I would say. So he's born to a wealthy family. He never forgets that he's been born to a wealthy family. He dresses flamboyantly is maybe too strong of a word, but also maybe not quite too strong of a word. He really cares.
Ostentatiously.
Yes, he tends towards vanity in his looks, for one. He knows he's well educated, another thing that I've recently come across is John Newton, who's ministering similar time period, and you have the Clapham sect and William Wilberforce and those Anglicans of the evangelical stripe who are pushing for societal change, especially the abolition of slavery. And John Newton, author of Amazing Grace, forms this group in London called the Eclectic Society, in which he gathers together different, mostly Church of England folks, but a few other folks, clergy, but a few lay folks, and trying to work through some of the societal issues, really, or if not directly societal, kind of pastoral. How do we preach the doctrine of election to our people? What are the good ways of doing that, and what are the bad ways of doing that? And Simeon is involved in some of those conversations, but he also stays at a distance. And so I think one of looking with a close eye at Simeon, one of the things that I'm disappointed. I mean, not that I really have, but Simeon never embraces the idea of abolishing the slave trade or anything like that to the degree that Newton and Wilberforce especially have. He kind of says, well, if you guys want to go do that, go and do that, but I'm not really going to get too concerned about it. Mm-hmm. And I consider that a weakness of his, but I think maybe that him being wealthier and him being of higher class and being less concerned maybe with societal ills, mm-hmm. allows him, or is maybe what even keeps him in the Church of England. I mean, he's not going to ride around the country on horseback like John Wesley does. I mean, just kind of destroying his body in order to preach the gospel. He has this church, and he's going to work at where he's at.
And he's there for 55 years.
He's there for 55 years. Right. Yeah. And so, I mean, just as, so I think maybe like in the same way that, I always mix the Wesleys up, same way that John Wesley's really disastrous marriage actually serves the gospel because he doesn't want to be at home, and so he's riding around the country preaching the gospel. In maybe the same way, Simeon's unwillingness or discomfort with maybe being down in the trenches of what's going on in the revivals allows him to positively contribute in the way that he does. Yeah.
Well, and that's a really good insight, because it shows that, like, God works through us in all our flaws, even, you know, Wesley through disastrous marriage, you know. And of course, that should be the top priority of any Christian, is their marriage. But but it's like, you know, God works through people despite the flaws, and despite maybe Simeon's comfort with the high life. And like you said, not wanting to get down in the trenches, God still used that in a certain way, you know. Yeah. Fascinating the stories these people from the past bring. We've kind of been in the 19th century for a little bit. And you being the president of EFAC, that's, of course, Evangelical Fellowship and the Anglican Communion, that is a product of the 20th century. Originally, of course, starts by evangelicals in the Church of England. And that brings us into the 20th century, with 20th century evangelicalism, which is its own distinct thing. Kind of talking about the characteristics of the 19th. What's the 20th century like? I don't think we ever really spent any time on kind of 20th century evangelical Anglicanism on any episode yet on Doth Protest. It might be a good opportunity to. I know, like, you're part of that history too, being a current president of EFAC. I mean, so.
Again, it could be a whole nother episode. Right before I do that, I think it's necessary to dip back into the very, very last years of the 19th century. And when we talk about Anglicanism in the 20th century, there's a big gap between kind of a British understanding of evangelical Anglicanism and a U.S. understanding. And they kind of go their separate ways for a while, and then kind of come back, but looking a little bit different. I'm going to focus more, being on this side of the pond, on the American version. So I think the connection, one of the connections that has to be made, is a man named Charles McIlvaine, who is originally born in New Jersey. He attends West Point. While at West Point, he has a similar kind of conversion experience, and yet stays. He's straddling the line between the Episcopal Church and the Presbyterian Church. His roommate at West Point, is one of the really famous Reformed Presbyterians.
Oh, okay, I know McIlvaine converted Polk. We actually discussed that on a previous episode, and we didn't actually have a whole class. So yeah,
it's one of the Presbyterian guys whose names I'm blanking on, but McIlvaine becomes a chaplain at West Point. He serves there for a while, is ordained, and goes and serves at some parishes, especially in New York. But later, McIlvaine becomes the first bishop of Ohio. He's sent to Ohio to do this, missionary work, really. I mean, it's still the frontier. And part of what he does, McIlvaine is a really fascinating character, but he also straddles both sides of the pond, often going back to England. And when he's back in England, meets and visits with Charles Simeon. So he meets Simeon in 1830, and then in 1835, and he's just enamored by Simeon and the work he's doing, and Simeon becomes an inspiration for him. So McIlvaine is serving as the Bishop of Ohio, and in the late 19th century, within American Anglicanism, you have the Episcopal Church, and up until this point, there's a very small group of folks who had left the Episcopal Church and tried to form what they called the Evangelical Episcopal Church, which didn't really go very far. But what ends up happening at the end of the 19th century is the group that is now known as the Reformed Episcopal Church has decided that with the rise of Tractarianism and then Anglo-Catholicism within the church and the rise of liberalism with the church, that it's better to just, as the more Reformed folks, just to leave the Episcopal Church. And so that happens. And when that does, Mac McIlvaine is committed to the Episcopal Church to the end, but is an old man and passes away. So tries to encourage these folks who want to leave the Episcopal Church to stay with it, but is ultimately fails. And so McIlvaine is really the last evangelical voice within the Episcopal Church. And so then what happens here in the States is in the early 20th century, you see a rise in Tractarianism or Anglo-Catholicism, as it's sometimes called. And you also have a rise of theological liberalism, which happens across the denominations.
And McIlvaine, sorry to interrupt, but he wrote a lengthy rebuttal, didn't he, of the, I think it was a rebuttal he called of the Oxford theology when Anglo-Catholicism was really forming and becoming what it was in the 19th century. He really wrote a scathing scathing work. Yeah.
I'm pretty sure the word papish is in that title. I can't come up with it now, but yeah, right. he's strongly convinced of the Reformed nature of Anglicanism and of the Episcopal Church. Mm-hmm. And there's another one where he, as bishop, he refuses to consecrate any church that that has an altar instead of a table. So he's the angry emails will come any moment now. But
this is an objective fact. That's what he did. If someone's angry about that, I mean, they can. He's a Charles when they see him in heaven.
So. Yeah, but he's a stalwart defender of this. But ultimately, I mean, kind of loses loses both because of the rise of Anglo-Catholicism and the departure of the Reformed Episcopal Church, which doesn't allow for a reform movement because there's no longer a Reformed or evangelical voice within the Episcopal Church. And so that continues for a while. And two, I mean, if you want a really long book about that, there's a book called Standing Against the Whirlwind. That's all about 19th century evangelical Episcopalians. There's also a shorter essay by a guy named Giles Harp, who, if you guys haven't had on, you should have him on. He's a historian, Anglican historian, and he writes, I think his article is called The Strange Death of Evangelical Anglicanism, or Evangelical Episcopalians. So what happens is this kind of brand or party of Anglicanism disappears in the U.S., and it really isn't doing real well in England either. You have, again, because of the Tractarians, because of more liberal theologies, but does a better job of kind of keeping on in England. So then really the next person you have to turn to I would argue the person that you have to understand anything about 20th century Anglicanism is evangelical Anglicanism, John Stott. Yeah. So John Stott is very similar to Charles Simeon in a lot of ways. They're both lifelong bachelors. Both come from kind of upper class backgrounds. both highly educated, and John Stott becomes rector of All Souls Langham Place in London in the early 50s, late 50s. I can't remember when exactly, but Stott really becomes enamored with Simeon as well, and looks to Simeon's example for a lot of what he does. Just becomes his mentor, really, from beyond the grave. Mm-hmm. And so you have, and if you're not familiar with John Stott, I mean, I can't do that justice in the time we have remaining.
I would recommend the book I read for him that I absolutely loved was Christ in Conflict.
Yeah.
Which Christ I think was originally titled Christ
the Controversialist.
Yes. And through his kind of exegeting and reflecting on the instances of Jesus coming in conflict, you know, usually with Pharisees or something like that, or just any, you know, he uses those moments to illustrate what the gospel is. He kind of uses those moments to draw from that, you know, the essence of Christianity. It's really a great work, fantastic work.
Yeah, the other one I would suggest is The Cross of Christ. That's really Stott's kind of seminal work, and exploring what the cross, what happens because of the cross. Mm-hmm. And that's probably the book that Stott will most be remembered by, but a prolific author. But he also, Stott, like Simeon, sees the need to train up clergy. He sees opportunities within the Church of England that still exist, even though they're not friendly to evangelicals necessarily, very similar to Simeon. Stott focuses a lot on college ministry. I mean, is a big part of the campus union movements that really take hold in the 50s and 60s. And it's also a strong proponent of missionary work. Hmm. And Stott himself traveling all over the world to lecture and teach and preach. So John Stott in the Church of England kind of serves this process of revitalization of what it means to be an evangelical, and J.I. Packer is right there alongside of him in doing that. But here in the States, there's not that John Stott isn't in this. There is no John Stott in the States. Right. So in the early 60s, Stott comes and visits the U.S. and starts meeting with some evangelical, you can't even really call them that, but start meeting with some Episcopalians, maybe more conservative Episcopalians, if you want a label, because there's just no really such thing as an evangelical Episcopalian.
The ones who weren't enamored with Pike, those Episcopalians, right?
Yeah.
That's who John Stott came in.
Yeah.
Worked with. So,
yeah, that's a good way of putting it. So he comes over and ultimately ends up, there's a few other kind of British evangelicals who end up coming and visiting and getting in touch with different parishes and whatnot. But because there hasn't been such a thing as an evangelical Episcopalian for almost 60 years, it's foreign. Even though, I mean, it wouldn't have been foreign. Stott would have gotten along fine with Charles McIlvaine, but there's no Charles McIlvaines. There's no Charles Simeons. There's nobody kind of like that. And what ends up happening is there are end up being some people kind of like that, but they're involved in the what becomes known as the charismatic renewal movement in the Episcopal Church. And so, that movement that's often is cited starting kind of Calvary Chapel out here in California. You see things like the Jesus People, the the beginnings of kind of contemporary Christian right. music and worship music, that type of thing is happening even in the Episcopal Church. And I actually just met a man a few weeks ago, a priest in the ACNA, who just has an incredible story of how God reached him through the Charismatic Renewal movement, and just a miraculous story.
So, but what you're saying is basically that the opportunity that kind of a classical evangelical expression had, that it had to maybe come back into the Episcopal Church, was kind of eclipsed by the charismatic renewal, which was going on at the same time. This is what, the 60s, 70s, the charismatic.
Yeah, I'm not sure eclipsed is quite the right word, but in order for a more historically understood version of evangelical Anglicanism to take root again in the U.S., it has to dovetail with this sure. with this charismatic movement that's taking sure. place.
And I see that a lot now in whatever evangelical or so-called evangelical pox the Episcopal Church is very much. It's a kind of a dovetailing of those two things, which is an interesting dovetailing.
So. Yeah, and now I think you see evidence of that if you're familiar with the idea of like the three streams movement within, especially North American Anglicanism, of that you can simultaneously, that the church needs to be simultaneously evangelical, charismatic, and Anglo-Catholic. And sometimes that's expressed as evangelical being kind of word-based, charismatic being kind of spirit-led, and Anglo-Catholic as being the liturgical component that kind of holds mm-hmm. it together. I'm not convinced that's a healthy way of understanding that or moving forward with that. But that is what happens in North America, is that because McIlvain lost, because the REC leaves, there's just nothing there. And so Stott, who is to his credit to his credit and or his detriment, depending on who you talk to, is very ecumenical in his approach. And so I might be going on a limb and saying this, but I don't think that was Simeon's kind of ideal of like, oh yeah, we can be Anglican and charismatic or evangelical and charismatic. But, mm-hmm. But those are the people that are willing to work with him. And so he does. And out of that, you have EFAC USA, is formed for a long time. We were called Fellowship of Witness. Mm-hmm. We were part of the Trinity School for Ministries founding in the early 1970s. We probably wouldn't be here now without that charismatic renewal movement, but also at the same time, I don't think it's the best way of understanding.
And I was gonna say, people can fault Stott all they want, I guess, for him willing to, you know, be ecumenical or participate with these different flavors that others would find, you know, problematic to do. But I mean, facing the 20th century, Stott's up against so many, I guess, cultural forces and just a type of a rapidly changed world. And I mean, definitely more secular world than the 19th century. And so Stott is interested in building friendships and building coalitions, really, for the sake of the gospel to be heard and for people to hear it. And so, I mean, I can see why he's willing to go these lengths McIlvain's just in a very different, McIlvain and Simeon are just in a very different time than, you know, the time Stott found himself in. So,
well, and it seems to me to be the case that with Stott, who has died in our lifetimes and lived That's a significant right. portion of his life in our lifetimes, Stott was trying to get all of these three streams to coalesce within Anglicanism because they shared a common commitment to Jesus that perhaps others within the Episcopal Church did not, or they paid lip service to it, but really didn't. But the problem is, and this is the problem that we see in the Episcopal Church today, we can say the name of Jesus, we can say the gospel, but we can be talking about diametrically opposed things. And I know for a fact that when I hear people in my sphere of influence speaking about the gospel, more often than not, they're conflating law and gospel, to use a Reformation dichotomy in effect. So if we can't agree on what the gospel is, it's going to be very hard to do ministry together. Not impossible, but very hard, because we're going to be fighting against each other. And this is one of the things that I feel like the ACNA has begun to realize as a convergence movement, is that there are all of these different streams that are working together, sort of, but also can be working opposed to one another. And so while it was a noble cause that Stott was engaged in, it does, I don't mean to sound fatalist when I say it almost seems futile, unless we can agree about core concepts.
Well, you just crashed. You just brought the mood all the way down.
And I think, but
he talked to too. Gosh, that's his mic drop.
Yeah. trying to pick that up a little bit, but trying to work. I think part of that is, and you mentioned this before we started recording, James, and I won't quote you exactly, but there's within understandings of what it means to be charismatic, or what it means to be Anglo-Catholic, or what it means to be evangelical, are some presuppositions. And I think that there's enough presuppositions within those three groups, especially. You could throw in another kind of wing of Anglicanism as being like a liberal or broad church understanding, but within the three that are trying to work within the ACNA, for example, explicitly, there's points of understanding at the root of them that are contradictory to each other. And so that will be that struggle. And that's part of, I think that's part of, the Episcopal Church that I'm gladly part of has a lot of problems. I'm not trying to say that we don't, but maybe it's the log in my eye. I mean, it's easier to see other people's problems. And I think you've kind of gotten to the heart of it in terms of the ACNA of saying what are the weaknesses of what it means to kind of try to value this three streams movement, or three streams understanding of Anglicanism. And so that's why, while like Stott, I'm happy to kind of work with whoever is willing to work with me. I think there's also some of those evangelical, distinctives that need to be recovered and need to be brought forth, and that's a big part of what kind of EVAC USA is doing. I mean, so our last conference, we talked a lot about liturgy. I mean, and a friend of the show, I'm not, that might be going too far, you can edit that out later, but Dean Garwood Anderson, up at Neshota House, I was talking to him, and he said, well, different strands of Anglicanism can get along pretty well, but you start going into liturgy and that's where you're gonna see the cracks the quickest. That's what we we tried to do just a month or two ago in our last conference, of saying what does it mean to worship and to use the liturgy in a evangelical and with an evangelical Anglican understanding. And Zach Hicks, who just most recently canon for worship and liturgy down at the Cathedral Church of the Advent in Birmingham, was our main speaker, and his conviction that the crux of his argument is that everything that we do liturgically and in worship, we have to measure that against the doctrine of justification by faith alone. So does this practice help us understand that doctrine and live that doctrine better, or does it hinder that?
It does help that. Yeah, it helps us that I see so much of this as a continuation, kind of in the spirit of Stott, and knowing that the doctrine of justification was so central to Stott and in his proclamation and in his writing. It is, you know, we talk about the convergences and some of the problems they bring with these different wings, but I think overall, I think, yeah, it's especially at EFAC and the conferences and the gatherings that EFAC has, that message is so central in all my experience with them. And so I'm really grateful for that. And I don't think you're off by saying, I don't know if Garwood Anderson is a friend of this show, but he's a friend of mine. He's a friend of you, yeah. Zach. And I think you know him, James, right?
Never met him. I haven't had the pleasure, but I hope to at some point.
He's a great guy. Our next episode with Stephen Chester, Garwood would actually, let's up Garwood's alley, not to like throw in a plug in for our next episode, but yeah. As far as Pauline exegesis and old versus new perspective, that's Garwood's kind of wheelhouse. But I'm glad he's part of EFAC as well. I mean, even though he's a dean of Neshota House, he is an evangelical. A lot of people don't. What a strange time we live in, isn't it?
One thing I want to say to Zach, I can't redeem myself, right? But perhaps to draw the mood back up, one of the things that you said that I think is so important and it bears reiteration is that I'm fine with anyone calling themselves an evangelical if we can stand behind justification by faith alone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
because that is so central to our identity, and that's so central to the Reformation, and it's the thing that the reformers fought and died for. That you know, you don't have to follow Bevington's 5 points or whatever, or you don't have to be a faithful follower of the 700 Club. If we can stand behind justification by faith alone, I'm good with that.
Yeah.
Amen. So yeah, I know James, you have to get going. Hope we're not having you run late, but we'll do a quick wrap up here. I guess Zach, if there's any what's so in the future because I wanted, you know, get listeners. I know we have some EFAC members, our listeners, but I'm so supportive of and just excited about your work. And in the work of EFAC, what's kind of on the horizon for EFAC?
Yeah, so part of, and to you said it earlier, I mean, what we're trying to lean into, especially in this coming year, is what I've started saying, tongue-in-cheek, our middle name, fellowship. I mean, that's, if nothing else, kind of what I think the main thing that EFAC serves to do is to gather people who can agree on just the doctrine of justification by faith alone. I think that there's more that we could kind of tighten that down into, but especially that within whatever Anglican jurisdiction you're in. So we have members from the Episcopal Church, members from ACNA, the UECNA, which is one of the continuing jurisdictions. So we really bring a lot of different folks together, and oftentimes it's people say, I come to this because that's one time a year where I can be with a group of people who are really on the same page with me in my diocese and in where I'm at. I just don't have that kind of support and encouragement. So, so truly trying to lean into that this year, hoping to do, I mean, we do an annual conference usually by at this point. I mean, we're a few weeks past our 2022 conference, and usually at the end of the conference, we say next year we're going to be, and that didn't happen this year for a few different reasons. So we're still working on what next year's conference might look like. But would welcome members. We're $75 a year. You can be a member. You can get a snazzy pin. Yes. Private Facebook group where we bounce ideas off of each other, sermon ideas, things like that. And just being part of this, this year, we're also going to be introducing parish memberships. So parishes that are interested in being counted among, as an EFAC USA supporter. And, what we're asking for is half of 1% of your operating budget. So that's, for some of our larger friends, that will be quite a bit of money, and some of our smaller parishes, that won't be as much money, but we'll welcome them. We also have one of the things that I'm really excited about is we are serving as a kind of a clearinghouse of different positions that become available in both in the ACNA and Episcopal Church, and connecting clergy, especially, but also laity, connecting clergy with churches that want that and are looking for someone maybe of a more evangelical convictions. And so we've been able to do that 3 or 4 times now in the last year and a half since we started that. So, if you're just looking to connect with more like-minded folks with in whatever Anglican jurisdiction you're in here in the U.S., that's really what we serve to do. So just kind of working towards that and seeing where that will lead us. So.
All right. And I'll put in our show notes a link to Evangelical Fellowship in the Anglican Communion's website and for people to check out and to read further. So thanks, Zach. It's been a wonderful show. God bless. Love to have you on again. So.
Yeah, thanks for having me.